This is Pacifica Network News, special election night coverage. I'm Larry Bensky.
What I predict for tomorrow night is that we will have more House seats, more Senate seats, more governorships, and more legislative seats to add to the enormous number that we have already gained under the Clinton administration.
That was, of course, House Speaker Newt Gingrich. The response from Bill Clinton talking about voter turnout. A lot of people predicted it would be low today, but in fact, it doesn't seem like it's turning out that way.
I don't know. I think a lot of people know this is a big election. I think they know what their priorities are, and you mentioned them, and I think they know what our priorities are. And I think they know that the Democrats are focused on the people out there in the country and not on some sort of partisan power games here in Washington.
Bill Clinton with a special election eve yesterday appearance on an African-American nationwide talk show. The results are in from several states already, and we'll give them to you right off the bat. They are not conclusive yet, but there are some interesting developments. The polls closed about an hour ago in South Carolina, and the incumbent Republican governor has been upset by a Democratic challenger. That is Jim Hodges in South Carolina, the newly elected Democratic governor, defeats sitting Republican Governor David Beasley. As for the Senate race in South Carolina, Ernest Fritz Hollings, the Democrat who's been in there for many terms, who was thought to be threatened in this race, has now been declared the winner of that race. Hollings will return to the Senate. That's a seat that the Republicans hoped that they would pick up. Looking at the House of Representatives in Indiana, a state where the polls closed, as I said, an hour ago, the seat of a retiring chair of the Intelligence Committee and ranking member now of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Lee Hamilton, looks like it's going to be retained by the Democrats in something of a surprise, with 28% of the results in. Barron Hill, the Democrat, leads Gene Lysig, a Republican, with 57-43%. Meanwhile, the Republicans had hoped to pick up Indiana's 10th district. Julia Carson, Democrat, serving her first term. She's a former mayor of Indianapolis and an African-American and a leader in the Black Caucus in Congress. But she is now ahead of her Republican challenger, 57-41%, with 71% of the precincts reporting. It looks like the Republicans are not going to win there. On the other hand, in Indiana's 8th district, the Democrats had hoped that they could upset incumbent Congressman John Hostetler, a member of the Newt Gingrich right faction in Congress, with Gail Reakin, a Democrat. But with only 9% of the precincts reporting, Hostetler has a not very comfortable, 53-46% lead. The other result we have so far is from Kentucky in the 4th district, the district where Scotty Baisler, who's running for Senate, stepped down. The Democrats look like they're going to retain that seat with 65% of the vote reporting. Ken Lucas, the Democrat in Kentucky, leads Jex Williams, the Republican, who has 47% to Lucas's 53%. Joining us at this time on Pacifica Network News on our special election night coverage is, I almost said recovery, we'll need a recovery after this, is Jim Hightower, former Texas Agricultural Commissioner, wit and pundit. Jim Hightower joining us from Texas. Welcome to Pacifica Radio once again, Jim Hightower.
Glad to be back with you, Larry.
Jim Hightower, your reaction so far to the fact that the Democrats have held some seats that the Republicans were looking for in Kentucky and Indiana?
Well, and again, what you're really seeing, though, is the power of incumbency there. The real question to me is not whether Democrats or Republicans win, but whether it represents any kind of a change with those victories. As we are really seeing, you mentioned turnout earlier being higher than anticipated, it will still be at a remarkable low level, certainly beneath half of the voters in the country will be turning out. But we had a massive turnout of dollars.
Oh, we sure did.
More than $1 billion spent in just the congressional races alone. And this has become the dominating force in our politics today.
What is your reaction to the fact that Democrats have retained the Senate seat in South Carolina and taken over the governorship, Jim Hightower?
Well, that there's some level of common sense. I mean, Fritz Hollings has, on issues like NAFTA and other elements of the Globaloney policies, pursued, by the way, by Clinton as well as by Newt Gingrich and Trent Lott, he has been very independent on that, has been against those policies. So he has run the kind of campaign that is much more in tune with the ordinary workaday person.
Jim Hightower, Texas Agricultural Commissioner. This is Pacifica Radio's national news coverage. Jim Hightower, if Texas, as they say tonight, goes very heavily for, and I don't think there's any question about it, for your Governor Bush for re-election, and he's going to be launched, of course, immediately by the media and already has towards the White House, what does it mean for Texas politics, for progressives in Texas who are trying to maintain some kind of foothold there? Is he going to drag all the Democrats down with him?
I don't think so. I think that Jim Maddox, for example, will win. That's going to be a close race, too. But Jim Maddox is a former attorney general, was elected with me and Ann Richards and Gary Morrow back in 1982, has come back to run for attorney general again, has run a real populist people's campaign, and he's, in fact, the only guy running as a Democrat in Texas. And the result is he seems to be the Democrat that's winning.
What about the House of Representatives in Texas? The Republicans are looking to pick up about 5 seats. I've got 4 of them charted here in various districts. Some of these are Democrats in name only. They vote like Republicans most of the time, like Charlie Stenholm. Others, like Martin Frost, are prominent national Democrats. Indeed, he's head of the Democratic National Congressional Campaign Committee. Do you think the Republicans can actually pick up seats in Texas this time?
They could. I don't know. I haven't heard on the Stenholm race, but that one is a possibility. I mean, Stenholm, as you indicated, essentially is a Republican. And Harry Truman once said, if you give the people a choice between a Republican and a Republican, they will choose the Republican every time. And that could ultimately happen to Charlie. It's very interesting that he now comes running back to the Democrats saying, oh, save me, save me. But he's never there when the vote comes down. I think the most important races, Larry, and this is going to be several days down the road before we're able to tally these, but these are the state legislative races across the country, because there's a huge turnover in state legislatures due to term limits. And those are going to be the people who do the reapportioning. Just 2 years down the road, as a result of the 98 and the 2000 elections, that class of state legislators will reapportion the congressional seats in this country. Those are extraordinarily important races, and that's where a lot of activity by the New Party, by the Greens, by the Reform Party, some of the third party efforts, as well as progressive Democrats, have been focused. And that's where I think we're going to see real change down the road coming forward as a possibility, at least.
Jim Hightower, the possibility that the Christian right may have peaked in 1996, a lot of people are talking about this, but you in Texas have seen an assault on your state education board, among other things. They seem this time not to be as active above the radar screen, but of course you've got those 50 million voter guides that they're handing out in churches. What's your take on that in an election like this, where the turnout is predicted to be low, although it's not going to be as low as they said? The influence of the Christian right, has it peaked, or is it still a major factor in places like Texas?
Still definitely a major factor, because they are organized, they are targeted, they do get their vote out. By the way, that's not necessarily a bad thing, a bad model for the rest of us to consider. I mean, that kind of grassroots organizing is something that our side might begin to pay some attention to, instead of just dumping all of our money into television ads and into political consultants. Nonetheless, the right-wing Christian right remains a very strong force, and not just in Texas, and not just in the rural areas, but in some, you know, supposedly sophisticated centers as well.
Jim Hightower, thank you very much for joining us
on
Pacifica Radio's special election night coverage. To repeat what we opened with, the Democrats have held 3 seats in Indiana and Kentucky that the Republicans have hoped to take tonight. The Republicans have held 1 of their seats in Indiana that the Democrats had hoped to take, and they held another one in Kentucky as well. We're just getting results at Ann Northrup, a Republican, former mayor of Louisville, has retained her seat in Kentucky's 3rd district. A Democrat, on the other hand, has upset Fob James, one of the poster boys of the Christian right, for governor of Alabama. That would be Don Siegelman. Don Siegelman defeats Fob James, a hard right Christian conservative, as the governor of Alabama. Many people said that James was bad for business, and the electorate in Alabama seems to have agreed. On our next report, at the top of the next hour, we'll be taking a look at the New York and North Carolina Senate races, plus many more House races. We've identified 46 House races on Pacifica Radio here tonight that are crucial, and we'll be following those throughout the evening. So stay with us. I'm Larry Bensky. This is Pacifica Radio's Election Night Special Report. And you'll hear the next update at exactly 9 o'clock here on WBAI in New York. Time now for Off the Hook.
is ringing, so I ripped it off the wall.
Okay, we're running late, so we don't have time for that, so let's just get right into the show. It's election night here in New York. Actually, it's election night everywhere. Well, everywhere in the country, anyway. And we have some foul-ups and blunders to report already. Yes, you might have heard about this one. ABC News. Boy, they really fouled things up this year. May not have been Dewey defeats Truman, but ABCNews.com's posting of test election results on its website was an embarrassing mistake on the eve of Election Day. It wasn't our finest hour, spokeswoman Michelle Bergman said Tuesday. The outcomes of Senate and gubernatorial races and ballot issues for all 50 states were posted Monday afternoon. For example, it had Democratic Lieutenant Governor Gray Davis beating Republican challenger Dan Lundgren 49% to 46% in the California governor's race. And in New York, it had incumbent Republican Alphonse D'Amato beating Representative Charles Schumer in the Senate race 50% to 42%. Right away, you know that's fiction. So, I don't know. A very interesting bit of news that they generated themselves there. Bergman said ABCNews.com was testing its pages for election coverage, and some pages inadvertently got published live. Woohoo! She said the numbers did not reflect what ABC expected to happen. It was something that I guess they concocted out of thin air. There is no bias intended by what we posted, and the predictions do not reflect the reporting or news judgments of ABC News, just our overall computer incompetence. She estimated that the results were available for a couple of hours on Monday. If anybody has those, if anybody saved those, please send them on over. We'd certainly like to see them. Monday's bobble was a far cry from America's most famous election foul-up. In 1948, the Chicago Tribune erroneously announced that Republican Thomas E. Dewey had defeated President Truman. Well, Election Day is not over yet, so we could still surpass that. And we'll be following various election results throughout the night here on WBAI. Here's something interesting, a pre-election day bit of news. October 27th, the New York State Police, acting under the orders of Attorney General Dennis Vacco, who is up for re-election, seized computer equipment that Buffnet used to provide its subscribers with access to internet news groups. It's like seizing envelopes to combat mail fraud, said Buffnet attorney Stephen Fox. Or taking the cable for what's on TV. According to a press release, Buffnet remains fully operational and continues to provide service to its 7,400 customers. Buffnet is not charged with any crimes. Buffnet has not broken any laws. None of the individuals who were arrested were Buffnet members or employees. None of the allegedly illegal material was posted from Buffnet accounts. Buffnet receives its news group feeds from Sprint's network, from Prodigy, and from several educational institutions. These feeds are unmoderated, the same as radio and TV signals through the air. Buffnet supports the Attorney General's goal of preventing harm to minors. In fact, before these events, Buffnet's attorney spoke with attorneys in Vacco's office and the Department of Justice in Washington. Buffnet learned it has been doing more than what the law requires and everything the DOJ advises. Buffnet's staff and attorney even appeared with the Attorney General on Adelphia Cable's show on regulating the Internet. Ironically, Mr. Vacco was impressed with the job Buffnet was doing to fight child porn and fraud. We haven't changed since, reported Buffnet President Gary Buschetti. It is important to know that Buffnet did not create the content under investigation by the Attorney General. Buffnet also cannot control the postings to the news groups, nor any ISP bound by any state or federal law can do that. The financial resources needed to scan and evaluate the legal consequences of 37,000 news groups, each with hundreds of postings a few times a day, are not available to Buffnet nor any ISP. I believe that if Buffnet is guilty, then so is Sprint, Prodigy, and a few major educational institutions that provide us the news feeds, said Buffnet President Gary Buschetti. Why didn't Mr. Vacco take all the phone wire in New York? These images went through the wire, which has as much control as Buffnet does. When someone sends illegal material through the U.S. mail, they don't arrest the people in the post office. It seems like the Attorney General arrested the people who posted. They didn't have Buffnet accounts. Federal law protects ISPs. Isn't it intriguing that Vacco chose only two ISPs, both in upstate New York? Is it coincidence that Vacco won his last election relying on upstate New York votes? Why weren't the other 1,000-plus ISPs in New York State a target of his investigation? Why weren't Buffnett's peers that provided the news groups under investigation? It's another clear example of selective prosecution. So it'll be interesting to see if this particular move helps re-elect Attorney General Dennis Vacca. We'll be following that race as well throughout the night. And we have a couple of guests with us tonight. A few guests, actually. We have Bill SF is here from Amsterdam. Bill, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine.
And we have on the phone from North Carolina, Kerry, the webmaster of KevinMitnick.com. Kerry, are you there? You're going to have to speak up just a little bit.
Hi.
Okay, that's it. That's great. And basically, we'll start with you, Bill. You've been traveling around the country the last couple of weeks for not the first time.
This is about the fourth time I've been in the United States in about the last 9 years or so. And, this is so far so good. It's been a very good holiday. Mm-hmm. We've had a great time. I have my friend Yost here, who hopefully will say hello and get the nerve at some point. And we've found a few things shocking about being here. I mean,
What's shocking? We want to know what's shocking.
War on drugs and the basic politics in the U.S. and elections and all
the war on drugs continues on. You know, I've been learning more about this over the past few weeks.
Yes, it continues on, and marijuana sells for $50 for 2 grams, which is just, I mean, I just went, no way.
We can't give prices out over the air. But
I'm sorry.
the war on drugs is really out of control here, building prisons left and right. I was just in Philadelphia this past weekend, and it's unbelievable. They're building a maximum security federal penitentiary right smack in the middle of town. And, you know, they have these signs on the construction site saying that it's illegal to take pictures of the building. It's illegal to take pictures. I find that amazing. Of course, we took lots of pictures. And, you know, we'll continue. And I'll say right on the air, if that's the law, I'm going to break that law left and right. We take pictures of prisons all over the damn place because these are buildings, you know. And you stick them in the middle of a city and tell people, oh, you can't take a picture of that. It's just out of control.
It's also civil disobedience, isn't it?
Well, I guess it turns into that.
But why build more prisons? I mean, if you eliminate the war on drugs, you can... You can make a moratorium on the building of prisons. Although I guess a big business has an interest in building prisons because
it's an industry.
A lot of people.
No, it's an industry, and by putting minor drug offenders, by putting computer hackers, by putting every person you can think of in prison, you make money for these towns, these businesses that build prisons. It really is a booming industry. And they estimate that we're almost up to 2 million prisoners right now.
So I've heard about almost 1%, but I've also heard what is even more scary is that up to 5% of the people in the United States are under direct control of the government, which means that this is like how Nazi Germany was before before the war.
Well, you see, if you're under direct control, at least you know that you're under direct control. You get those
little
notices.
Yeah, but if you mess up, you go to prison.
But how about all the rest of us that think we're free, but actually are just doing exactly what they want us to and supporting these things and saying, yeah, you know, this crime on the streets, we have to build more prisons to, you know, to put the people away.
That's foul logic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, look at Amsterdam, where Yost and I come from. It's mm-hmm. Very free. I mean, and the crime rate is almost nothing. I mean, 1/20th the prison population. I mean, it's night and day.
Well, you know, I attribute that to the fact that you guys don't have guns all over the place.
We don't have guns all over the place, and you shouldn't have guns all over the place in the U.S. either.
It's amazing
because it's going to generate some calls.
If you look at the way things are, if you look at all the attention that's being drawn towards things, the authorities are so concerned about speech, about what is being said on the net, about what people are posting and copyright issues, what you have access to, what you listen to, what you read. The fact that little kids have access to things that can blow their heads off, that's secondary. That doesn't matter so much. But speech, that's a danger. That's what you got to lock people up for things like that.
You mean this is a situation where the system administrator is responsible in America for what's on his system?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I run two fairly big servers in Amsterdam, and it's none of my responsibility what's on it. If somebody complained there was kiddie porn, I would immediately remove it. But otherwise, I don't have to go checking through all the pages and see what people have up there.
Right, because that turns you into Big Brother, and you have
to. I'm not Big Brother. No,
you have to look for crimes before they're even committed.
Right,
It's really
there is an option to do fascist logging on Unix systems, and they say don't use it, but maybe some countries it's required.
Well, it's like you say, an option. It's not something that that any clear thinking person, I think, should be running.
Never.
If you're running a system just to keep an eye on everybody, why don't you just be a prison guard? You know, it'd be a lot easier and more direct. So it was really scary because we were talking to Bernie S. down there, and many of you are familiar with his case back a couple of years ago. In fact, if you're interested, we just put the 1996 Off the Hook radio shows on the actually was it 96 or no I'm sorry 95 just went up online on the website, and that is the year that Bernie S. really started to go through his personal hell, being targeted by the U.S. Secret Service, put in prison for nearly 2 years. And you can hear him calling into this radio show, talking to us from prison. You can hear the whole thing unfolding, and that just went up on the net. You can go to www.2600.com and listen to those programs. So that brings it back right there. But talking to him about it, we sort of went over all this stuff again, and it was just, it really hit me hard just hearing all of this again, hearing the things that the government will do to you if they want to target you, if they think that you're somebody that's a danger. It doesn't matter if you are a danger or not. If they think you are, they'll convince judges, they'll lie in court, they'll do whatever they need to do. They'll fabricate evidence if they have to. That is not an exception. And, you know, a lot of us go through life thinking it is an exception, but when you see it happen to somebody close to you, when you see it happen several times to different people, you realize they're not playing by the rules. They make their own rules.
Well, they are the law, therefore they make the rules. Mm-hmm. He who has the gold makes the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they have the gold, and the U.S. government thinks they have the gold now. And, I should be reasonably careful because I don't believe there's freedom of speech anymore in America, and I should...
Well, it's the worst.
Not really speak my mind here.
It's the worst kind because we believe there's freedom of speech, but when you look around, all the radio stations are owned by the same people, all the TV stations, all the newspapers. You know, obviously BAI is an exception, and it's a really rare exception, and one that I don't doubt is in very great danger because a lot of people see this place as a threat because we speak our minds, and we're not owned by, you know, the same people that all the other radio stations are owned by, and we don't have commercials and that kind of thing. You know, it's a rare exception. You have to ask yourself, why is it a rare exception?
Why is it allowed?
Yeah. Why should speech be considered such a threat? This is a good point to bring in Kerry from North Carolina. Kerry runs the Kevin Mitnick website. First off, Kerry, are there any updates on Kevin's case?
Since the last show?
We haven't been on for 3 weeks, so I guess some things have happened. Has he had any hearings?
Bail denial, the second bail denial, that went through since then, didn't it?
It's a bail hearing denial.
Bail hearing, yeah.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind that Kevin has yet to have a bail hearing. He's never had a bail hearing. Timothy McVeigh had a bail hearing. The World Trade Center bombers had a bail hearing. But Kevin Mitnick, no bail hearing. They're not even going to say you can't have bail. They're just not even going to give him a hearing. I mean, it boggles the imagination. So I guess that's the latest, that he has not had any bail hearing.
He's still there, and he still hasn't been allowed to look at the evidence.
Mm-hmm. There's a new thing that you put up on the website saying how many pages he would have to look through. Can you explain that to us?
Yes. There was 9.75 gigabytes of computerized evidence, and we just basically broke that down into pages, and it updates every day and tells you approximately how many pages he'd have to go through every day if he was to review all of that by the trial date.
And how many pages would he have to go through each day between now and the trial date if he wanted to look at his evidence?
It's about 33,000 something.
So he'd have to read 33,000 pages each day between now and the trial date, January 19th.
Yes.
Unbelievable. Now, people ask, there are a lot of questions, and I'm glad we have the opportunity to dispel some of this, because people always ask questions about Kevin being in prison, and they say things like, well, didn't he commit this crime? Didn't he give up his right to a speedy trial? First of all, Kevin did give up his right to a speedy trial, but that was back when he didn't have the, you know, think in his wildest imagination he'd be held in prison for 4 years without a trial, and also he thought he'd have access to the evidence so that he could prepare a defense. He might as well have gone on trial the first day after he was arrested, because he's seen as much evidence now as he's seen then. Now, when you give up your right to a free trial, it's so that you can have time to prepare an adequate defense. He hasn't been given that opportunity. So now, what are some of the other points that that people raise, saying that...
The accusations?
Yeah, the accusations against Kevin that... I believe somebody posted a story recently that listed all kinds of things that he never did.
Right. That was from 1988, and there's been other articles. There was the one that John Markoff did, 94. they've perpetrated all kinds of myths about him ever since 1988, that he's stolen credit card numbers, that he's changed credit records, that he broke into NORAD, all these things that they just presented as fact. They never presented any kind of justification, and in fact, a lot of them are false.
I think almost all of them are false. I think all of them are false, actually, the ones that I've seen. The NORAD never happened. As far as changing credit reports, there's no evidence to suggest that anyplace. Stealing credit card numbers, he had a file on one of his computer accounts that was spread all over the internet, and again, he never used any of those. So all of these things, if you look at them piece by piece, they can all be completely dispelled, and so that leaves you with the case. You know, what is this case actually about? Mm-hmm. And it's really a case of the government saying this guy's a threat because he knows too much. He has access to computers. He knows how to read certain files. And again, we're talking about something that happened years ago involving analog cellular software that really is worthless now. And all the companies, I think somebody sent us some information about this, all the companies that supposedly were victimized posted record profits in that period of time. Mm-hmm. So what kind of damage did the guy really do?
And not only that, but they're supposed to make statements about that kind of a financial loss in their statements to their stockholders, and none of them did.
So right away, where is the evidence? What exactly are they saying this guy did? It seems to me they're simply holding him because they can and because they want to send a message to the rest of us. And I don't know. I don't know. Where do you think this is going to go?
I think Markoff will probably write another book.
Yeah. You think he'll be there covering the trial? I'll bet
probably. Yeah. I mean, he's made an incredible amount of money off of all of this.
Mm-hmm. And he's not the only one. I mean, we have film companies that are making money. We have all kinds of other reporters that are going to be covering this story. You know, it's big news. But what everybody seems to forget is that there's somebody in prison suffering, and it's wrong. It has to stop. And one thing I learned over this past weekend is that, you know, we talk about Kevin a lot. Sometimes people think we talk about Kevin too much. But the point is, we know about Kevin's case. Kevin is somebody that we're familiar with, and we can speak to this issue. But there are so many other people out there, not just in the computer field, but all kinds of people everywhere that are being victimized in so many ways. And, you know, you'd need a network of radio stations to be able to give adequate time to all these people and tell them what's really happening. It's sad, it's shocking, but what's even scarier is the fact that people just go about their daily lives and not be tuned into this at all, not even care. That's the really scary part.
Well, by helping Kevin, we're helping ourselves, too, because this is going to be a really precedent-setting case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It already is a precedent-setting case in that every hacker that gets raided in the next 10 years is going to have the name Kevin Mitnick thrown in his face. They're going to say, you know, we did this to Kevin. We put him in jail for 4 years without even having a trial. We can do it to you. And they probably can. So that's the message that they want to send. That's the message I think they're going to be sending rather successfully. There was an article in last Saturday's New York Times, front page article, I believe, all about something called hacktivism. That's right, hacktivism. The headline was, "Hacktivists of all persuasions take their struggle to the web." And I'll read you a couple of paragraphs because that's really all I want to read. Until they declared net war against the Mexican government, Ricardo Dominguez and Stefan Rey earned their activist credentials the old-fashioned way, attending rallies in support of the Zapatista rebels, handing out pamphlets, shouting political slogans. Now the two New Yorkers organize virtual sit-ins and recruit computer programmers to attack the worldwide websites of any person or company they deem responsible for oppression. Their new rallying cry, "The revolution will be digitized." That's right. Hackers, while reliably anti-authoritarian, tend to limit their critique of the military-industrial complex to its imperfect computer security apparatus. Enamored of their image as the cowboys of the electronic frontier, most at least pay lip service to the hacker mantra, "Information wants to be free." Something I don't think we ever made up, but I'll get into that some other time. Whatever capacity they might have to disrupt the social order has so far been largely restricted to pointless vandalism and pinching the occasional credit card number. Unbelievable. They say this without having any examples or evidence of any sort. There is so much else that they could be talking about here, but they they choose to limit it. October 27th, the day after China's Human Rights Agency announced its new website, the official view of that nation's human rights record was replaced with an electronic trespassers manifesto. China's people have no rights at all, never mind human rights. How can the United States trade millions and millions of dollars with them and give them most favored trade status when they know what is happening? Earlier in October, computer intruders scrolled Save Kashmir over the opening screen of a website that the Indian government set up last summer to provide information about the region whose ownership is disputed by Pakistan and several separatist groups. The hacked site included photographs of Kashmiris allegedly killed by Indian forces, overlaid with the words massacre and extrajudicial execution. In June, after the Indian government conducted nuclear tests, college students in Britain and the Netherlands claimed credit for placing the image of a mushroom cloud on the website of India's major nuclear weapons research center. And in September, Portuguese hackers modified the sites of 40 Indonesian servers to display the slogan Free East Timor in large black letters, and they added hypertext links to websites describing Indonesian human rights abuses in the former Portuguese colony. Hacktivism is a way to be heard by millions, say one of the Mexican hackers. We want to speak out about what we and many people disagree with in this treasonous and corrupt government. If we protest both online and offline, we'll have better chances to see a change. Now, they go on at great length, but the thing I found most interesting about this article was what they didn't say, what they didn't talk about. The New York Times, the very newspaper that is publishing this, was hacked itself by, I mean, you may not consider them political activists, but maybe they are political. They're activists of some sort. They got a message out. They had something to say. I just can't believe the Times would choose not to point attention to itself when the very thing they're reporting in this story happened to them. And, of course, keep in mind that a major part of that story had to do with Kevin Mitnick, who the New York Times has also been kind of found guilty of, I guess, using. They used Kevin Mitnick for profit. They used him to sell books, to make news stories, without checking the facts, without being responsible. And, of course, by mentioning the fact that they were hacked, they would have had to have mentioned Kevin Mitnick, and then they would have had to have gotten into how the New York Times was implicated in this whole thing. And I guess they just felt, nah, we're not going to do that. We're not going to make that the news. We'll just eliminate it altogether. So this has been passed around the net. Bill, had you seen the story at all?
No, I know nothing about this story.
Yeah.
This is all news to me. In fact, most of the stuff you have been putting out is actually news to me, because I'm kind of in a different world, more into what's going on technically, and this political stuff is kind of is interesting. I mean, I of course I know Kevin Mitnick was in prison. I mean, I actually told you in Holland that I thought, didn't he get out some time ago? I mean,
people actually think that, huh? They think
a lot of people think he's gotten out, because it's just not believable that somebody would be in prison that long without a trial.
And that's the thing, you know, when we were traveling across country interviewing people about this, people would say, no, that's not possible, that can't be happening, you're wrong. There's no way this could be happening in this country. And how do you tell people, you know, you're wrong, it is happening, you know, here's the proof, we talk to him every day, he's in prison, he's been there for 4 years.
Well, we went into a locksmith shop and we found out that in New York State that it's illegal to sell lockpick tools to anybody but a licensed locksmith. And we said, well, in Europe, we kind of, it's a hobby. Us hackers like to play around with locks. And the guy kind of goes, well, you know what happens to hackers. I'm sure he was thinking about Kevin at that one.
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of people have heard about Kevin. The news is being spread all over the place. Carrie, perhaps you could tell us something about that. Where is the word being spread?
Oh, we've got hits on the site from all over.
Uh-huh. Has that increased in recent weeks?
It has. It went up about 10,000 requests this week. I think there were some links from another hacked website that might have contributed to that.
Yeah, it seems every time a website gets hacked, they put in a link to the Kevin Mitnick site, which it's kind of a mixed blessing, because people think that Kevin is behind this somehow. Actually, Kevin really doesn't like this kind of thing to be happening. But I'm sort of split on it. I understand his point of view totally. But at the same time, the media has failed us so badly, the mass media, that is, that how else do you get the message out? You know, you have to rally in the streets, and these are our streets. So That's basically what people are going to do. You can only push so far before, you know, people get fed up and don't start playing by the rules anymore. So, are there any other points that you wanted to bring up, Carrie, as far as the website or things that people have been asking or contributing?
I've been surprised how many emails from the site that I've gotten, people still asking, didn't he steal credit card numbers and stuff like that, just propagating these myths. And, I mean, all the information is on the website, you know. We tell people he didn't, but I think we need to do more. We need to write to these newspapers every time they print something. Everybody send letters.
That's right. And I can't tell you how helpful that is. When people send letters, it actually does do good. You don't think it does any good, but it does, because the reason is so few people send letters. Everybody thinks it doesn't do any good, so nobody does it. So then the few people that do it, it winds up actually having an effect. Of course, you know, there are newspapers and TV stations that just ignore whatever you say no matter what. But, you know, it can't hurt to try. And if it fails, then you try someplace else until eventually you get the word out. And I'm confident that that we will reach people, and the word is getting out. I think a lot more people know about this now than, say, 6 months ago or even 3 months ago.
Definitely. We've seen the requests on the site have gone way up just in the past few months. It's gone way, way up. So I can see that people are looking at it.
Yes, and we're getting all kinds of offers to help. Is there anything in particular that we need on the site that should be that maybe somebody could help us with? Because we don't want you to be overwhelmed.
Some people on the Mitnick mailing list are helping out. We're trying to index some of the legal documents so that people can get through those more easily.
Uh-huh. And there's all kinds of interesting things hidden in those legal documents, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can see a lot of things that we're trying to point out now, like the bias on the part of Judge Feltzer.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clear in those hearings.
Right, and also things that that will prove that Kevin wasn't even considered a fugitive when he was arrested, or actually when he first went on the run. There is substantial evidence to show that that was concocted, that he was not actually a fugitive, that he had served out his parole, and that there was no reason to come after him.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's take some phone calls. 212-209-2900. This is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein. We have Carrie in North Carolina, our webmaster for www.kevinmitnick.com. I should also point out that the site is now mirrored on www.freekevin.com, so that might actually be easier for some people to spell out. And we have Bill SF in from Holland, and I believe you're going out to the West Coast pretty soon.
Yes, tomorrow we're flying out.
Okay, so if you want to catch Bill SF and you're on the West Coast, just check the tour sheet, and I guess you can be part of that whole event. How long are you going to be in the country for?
How long have we been here, Yost? It's been about,
1 week so far. And
a little more than a week.
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks to go. And we got taken to L.A. We figured we were going to maybe spend 3 or 4 days maximum there, because most of the stuff I need to do is in the Bay Area. But people from L.A. keep contacting me. It just, the list keeps getting bigger and bigger, and I'm just going to have to pick and choose.
Yeah. Do you want to give out your email for if more people want to reach you?
If I have to give out my email, it's billsf@cuba.xs4all.nl, and I read it daily, at least once a day. And if you want to see us, shall we give out, Yos?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. If you want to see our trip as it progresses, go to leave out the www. Just type in your browser cuba.xs4all.nl/USA_trip, and you will see
slash.
Wait, where's the slash?
At the end.
Oh, you don't need that slash.
The browser automatically.
Yeah.
So much hits twice.
Okay. If you're using Explorer, maybe you need the slash. I don't know.
Exploder, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so that has all the pictures. Yeah, I saw some of those pictures, actually.
And you're
taking pictures now, too. So
you're taking pictures here.
We'll be on there pretty soon.
Yeah, you're going to be on.
Yeah, so you'll see us
talking
about this. But, okay, that sounds like fun. You'll be out on the West Coast, so people out there want to get together, talk about the phone systems, because you're a telephone expert of years past.
Yes, of years past. I've also noticed in the last 3.5-4 years that the phone system here has degraded quite a bit.
Now, why would you say a thing like that? What's wrong with our phone system?
Why would I say such a thing? Because Local calls sometimes lag for 2 or 3 seconds. I mean, it sometimes takes me 2 or 3 seconds to call somewhere local in New York City, Manhattan. But people that call me back from Holland say it takes like about a tenth of a second to connect.
Really?
So the setup time is much longer here.
Uh-huh. You know, it's interesting that, well, they have to add in all these things that they didn't add in before. If you make an AT&T call to another time zone, not OnePlus now, you hear the AT&T little slogan thing going by, right? But now you also hear the time. They tell you the time is whatever where you're calling, which I think is kind of useful, but still,
useful, yes.
It adds to the time it takes for the phone to start ringing, you know? So.
I haven't experienced that yet. I've just picked up the phone and called. I mean, for calling Europe, you got to really watch it on these prepaid phone calls, but some of them are a pretty good deal. We've gotten as low rates as 10 cents a minute to call Holland during business hours, but very often during the weekends and on the off hours, they'll jack the rates up to 20 or 30 cents a minute.
Mm-hmm.
There's another phone card, which I won't mention the name of, that uses a 1-800 number that charges 14 cents a minute to call Holland, which is quite a bargain, but I learned that it was almost a dollar a minute to call the west coast of the U.S.
Wow, so they get you in various ways. And when
they
you have,
get you one way or
when
another.
When you have a prepaid card, there's not much you can do about it. That's the thing.
No, but they only cost $5, so you just...
Yeah, but it'll go away in like, you know, a couple of minutes.
No, I learned from that $1 call to California that I'm going to just call some friends in Holland and burn this card up.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some nice chats with some friends back home, and
mm-hmm.
That's my thing about prepaid phone cards. I mean, you just got to shop around.
Right,
our
phone number is 212-209-2900. There's only a handful of calls on there, so we're going to take calls, but I'm not taking it if there's that few because I know who two of the calls are, and I don't want to take those ones. So let's light up that switchboard. We've only been gone 3 weeks, so I'm sure our listeners are still out there. 212-209-2900 if you're listening overseas, country code 1. And of course, we are being broadcast over the Internet. Maybe our Internet people can email us and tell us how many people are out there listening, and I'm sure we'd all be happy to hear that bit of information. Well, we got a few more, but not enough, so let's get some more phone calls. 212-209-2900. We're not even asking for money. We're just asking for phone calls. Terry, you still there?
Yep.
Okay. Anything new we can look forward to on the Mitnick page? Any new features?
I'm working with someone on the Mitnick mailing list right now to get some media information, more media-oriented information, things that can be sent to the newspapers. We'll add press releases as things come out and stuff like that. Uh-huh. That should be up soon in the next week, I hope.
It's really turned into a very informative site, and anybody who's interested in the way things are going in this case should go there. It's really become the authoritative source, and I mean that's one of the positive things of the case is how well that's progressed. Now hopefully it can have some effect. Okay, we have a bunch of calls now, so we're going to go to this line over here, which I think is our lucky line, and hopefully we won't lose Kerry. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, this is Stefan Ray calling.
How you doing? Where are you calling from?
Well, I'm calling from Brooklyn.
Brooklyn. How's the signal coming in way over there?
Okay, fine.
That's good.
I'm the person who was in the article you just read.
Oh, really?
And I believe Bill and I met in Linz.
You were in the article about the ISP?
I was in the article on hacktivism.
Oh, on hacktivism.
Yes, Stefan, I wanted to make a very strong point that doing the flood pavilion was... I don't hear myself. Did I talk too loud?
I hear you.
You hear me, okay. Trying to flood a website by just ping flooding it or that flooding stuff was just nonsense because most of these websites that are really fascist are too stupid to use anything but NT, and all you have to do is log into an illegal port three times a second, and it will shut down the NT machine for sure.
Okay, we have an update on
so
our...
So just basically do a strobe.
Yeah, I know. But we're trying to do something a little bit different. We're trying to do a mass action that involves lots of people.
But I can do it all myself, and I proved it to the people that were sitting around me. I guess you weren't there, but I proved it to Rop and the people around me that one man could wipe out all the sites you wanted to wipe out with one computer.
Yes, I know, that's true.
Yeah. Bill, can you take down the Internet in 30 minutes?
Can I take down the Internet in 30 minutes? Probably not.
Okay.
I can take down 3 sites in 30 minutes.
But I don't know the name of the announcer. Am I talking to?
Emmanuel.
But you were making some comments about the New York Times and their lack of coverage or not mentioning the New York Times website.
Right.
Well, I spent a lot of time actually talking to this particular New York Times reporter. Her name is Amy Harmon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that she was the same reporter that wrote a story about the attack on the New York Times site.
Yes, you're right. You're
earlier
right.
on. You know, even though it's, I mean, it takes a lot of time with some of these journalists. You have to really nurture them and move them along. I mean,
but this was their own newspaper.
Yeah.
The story should be fresh
in
their mind.
I know. It should definitely have been mentioned in there. Absolutely. But obviously, like, I think that there were some decisions made at an editorial level, above the level of the reporter.
I agree. I believe it's very likely that she wrote the story and the editorial, the editors just said, no, we're not going to mention this.
I mean,
instead, we're going to put in that one sentence saying that hackers steal credit cards.
Yeah. What she thinks she also didn't put in, she didn't put in our website address.
Well, you can put that in right now. Tell us.
Oh. Okay. Well, it's www.thing.net.
Thing.net?
Yeah.
T-H-I-N-G?
Yeah.
It's a good name. Okay.
It's the Thing is a server. It's based up on West 26th Street. It's an artist's server.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So it's www.thing.net/TildaRDom. Tilde RDOM, and then slash again, and then ECD, and then slash, and then ECD.html.
Wow, okay.
I know it's a complicated, we don't have our own domain name yet.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, anyways.
Well, that's good.
And just so you know, and you might be interested in this, the New York Free Media Alliance wants to put together a panel on the subject of hacktivism sometime in the spring. Actually, maybe in winter. So it might be good to have somebody from your show or people from 2600 involved in that.
Sure. Yeah, it sounds like a really interesting topic. Something that's definitely going to be the activism of the next century. It's going to be over the net.
Yeah.
So now, what kind of feedback have you gotten from the article?
From the New York Times article. Well, we got a call. We got a reporter from a Swiss business magazine, the largest Swiss business magazine. It's called Cash Magazine, believe it or not. And the reporter that's based in New York wants to do an interview with us, follow-up interview. And also, so does Voice of America, because we've been talking about the School of the Americas action in November.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in response from that. And then we just get all kinds of email messages all the time, from, you know, sometimes it's very obscure, you know, like, got something from somebody in Utah. Way out. They said, "Oh, we live in rural Utah. We're way the hell out in the middle of nowhere, and we saw this piece on mm-hmm. the front page of the New York Times. And just want to let you know that we you know support what you're doing and keep up the good work. That kind of stuff."
That's great. Now tell me, have you gotten any kind of flack from the authorities about all this?
Well, the closest thing that comes to that happened when we were in Linz. Just to make you understand what that means, we were at the Ars Electronica Festival on Information Warfare that was in Linz, Austria,
mm-hmm.
in the beginning of September, and we did something on September 9th. That's what Bill was just referring to. He was in that same space, right? And I was contacted, my university at New York University was contacted by somebody from within the Defense Information Systems Agency, complaining about complaining mainly about content on my website at NYU that was advocating and encouraging participation in these electronic tool disobedience actions. So I had to move.
Someone from DISA actually contacted your school.
DISA contacted the system administrations and security people at my school. Yes.
Wow. So they really are affected by this kind of thing. That's not even having a website.
They're affected more at the symbolic level, and they're affected. We've been Bill's correct in the pure technical sense. His critique of FloodNet, I think, is right on. But we've been able to simulate action, and we've been able to generate quite a bit of noise in the media sphere, which in the end is really what we want to do. And our main focus has been around the Zapatistas, right? That's been what our activity has been on. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, the effect, what happened on September 9th, we were doing a FloodNet action against the Pentagon's main website. It's www.defenselink.mil, and against Mexican President Zedillo's website and also the Frankfurt Stock Exchange website. And the defense people within DefenseLink, it's within DISA that manages, they have even managed the DefenseLink website, so it's people from in there. They did some sort of a Java countermeasure. Wired magazine got in touch with them while this was all going on, and got someone within DISA to sort of comment on this hostile Java applet against the FloodNet, so that was the one of the effects, really, was them doing some sort of a countermeasure, which as another journalist who I talked to from Defense News, who published a piece about this, said that this was the first time that he'd ever heard of the Defense Department sort of admitting that they had actually done some sort of offensive information warfare tactic against a domestic target,
mm-hmm.
meaning being us. And so that's, you know, it's all, these are sort of things that are happening with this, and it just, you know, it's happened very, very quickly and grown just since April.
Well, Stefan, I want to thank you for calling into the show. Be
okay.
sure to keep us updated on what happens.
Well, if you, give me an email or a website. Do you have a website for your show?
Yeah, you can read about it on 2600.com
okay.
/ off the hook.
All right.
Or you can email me, Emmanuel, at 2600.com.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that was Stefan Ray, was it, from Brooklyn, who was in the New York Times only a couple of days ago. I picked a good line there, didn't I? All right, we have an update on the real audio situation. We have 111 listeners from around the world right now, so welcome to all of them. Let's take one or two more phone calls. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just thought I'd point out that today is the 10th anniversary of the Internet Worm.
Is it really?
Yep.
Oh, how about that? 10th anniversary, huh? November 3rd, 1988.
Yep, and just as an interesting side note, Roger Morris got 3 years probation for taking down the Internet.
Robert Morris, yeah.
And Mitnick's still in jail.
That's a very interesting... you wouldn't be Robert Morris, would you?
No, I'm not.
Okay, I just wanted to check on that. Well, thanks for the pointer.
Yep.
All right. How about that? I wonder what he's doing today. You think he's celebrating? He and his pop probably celebrating the, you know, control over the information society.
Well, Robert Morris.
Yeah, Robert Morris Jr.
Yeah.
Okay, 212-209-2900. Let's go over here. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening. A technical question. You mentioned before that with the newer developments in caller ID, even if your number is blocked. Hello?
Yes.
Even if your number is blocked, they are now able to read your name. Is there any way of disabling that feature in addition to your number?
If your number is blocked, your name will be blocked as well on a caller ID device. That's not to say that the information isn't being sent. It's just that if it's configured properly, the switch is not supposed to display that information once it gets sent in. Bill, you have something to say on this?
Yes. I have a little bit to interject on this. Is that... if you, oftentimes, especially here in America, it just tells the other end not to display the information. And certain small phone systems choose not to even honor a block request and will send the information to the customer in the clear anyways.
Yeah, we had that situation with OmniPoint with their phones for a little while. They don't do it anymore, but they did it about a year or so ago.
And there's really nothing wrong with doing that. I mean, there is ANI. There's automatic number.
Well, there's something wrong with doing that. If you think you're blocking your number and they wind up displaying
that.
It,
yeah
that's not right.
Well, maybe there's a different perception of privacy in America than there is in Europe, because anytime you use the blower in Europe, I mean, they don't call it the blower for nothing.
Well, I mean, you guys didn't even have itemized billing for a long time because that was seen as an invasion of privacy.
Yes.
Now, explain to me the logic behind that. Seeing what numbers you call on a piece of paper, that's an invasion of privacy. What's the logic?
Yes, it's an invasion of privacy because it's all printed out on one nice sheet, and people can be traced who talks to who.
Uh-huh. You see, we're so used to that. We don't even think that's a privacy invasion.
But it definitely is.
Uh-huh. But you don't think there's anything wrong with your name and number being seen by somebody you call?
No, because I could figure out a way to call to avoid it.
Mm-hmm. But can most people?
Most people, no.
Yeah.
Most people are just flocks of sheep.
Do you have any more questions?
Or cows, as they say here in...
Yeah, I'm interested in the a while back you were talking about the ANI use for getting phone numbers, and in fact, many of the sites that were in fact hosting this particular feature had gone down.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there were any newer ones that you were aware of.
ANI numbers, yeah, there are a bunch. I don't have any offhand. I do know that I think if you call AT&T on various numbers, they still give you that information. I know AT&T's Spanish number does, so you can get the number that way. There are a bunch of them out there. You just have to sort of search around, find them by accident.
Right. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling. Let's see if we can squeeze in one more phone call. Let's try. Oh, I don't want to go over there. That's the dangerous part of town. Let's go over here. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, Emmanuel.
How you doing?
Hi. Nice show tonight.
Thank you.
I just wanted to know, last time I went to your website, Kevin Mitnick clock said 2 years and change. I understand it's much longer than that now.
I don't know when you would have seen that. Carrie, can you verify that the clock is right?
Last time I looked, it was right.
Uh-huh. It should be 3 years and about 8 months now, I think.
Let me go there.
Sometimes people have problems with different browsers. It messes up a bit and shows a few thousand years. Obviously, that's not right.
An older browser, yeah.
Yeah, an older browser might give you problems like that. So
right.
You just have to upgrade. But if it said 2 years, I don't remember that happening. There might have been some momentary glitch or something.
Okay, yeah, I tried it a couple of times. This is Dr. Z, by the way. I have a lot to say, but you don't have much time, so...
Yeah, we got a break for the election coverage in a couple of minutes.
Okay, well, I'll let you get on to other callers, and I just want to tell you, you're doing a good job, and I'm behind you all the way. And welcome to your guests from the Netherlands, and wish them luck.
Okay, thanks very much for calling.
You have a nice day.
Thank you. And that's going to just about do it for us as far as taking phone calls. Now, I just want to give Carrie a chance to give out any information for the website if people want to send mail to her over there or to, volunteer some resources or maybe information. Where should they mail you?
Carrie, K-E-R-R-Y, @2600.com.
Okay, great. And also, let's point this out real quickly. There was something involving Kevin's grandmother. Do you want to tell people about this?
Yeah, she suffered a mild heart attack on Friday. And so if people want to send her a Get Well card, the address is on the website. You can find it on the Defense Fund section. And it's the 2600 address.
Yeah, and you can send it through 2600 and we'll forward it on to her. Kevin's grandma is one of the nicest people I've ever met. She's extremely intelligent, articulate on this case, and there's no doubt that the pressures of this case are having an effect on everybody in his family. I know the one thing that she really wants is just to be able to see him again. And of course, she lives in Las Vegas. He's imprisoned in Los Angeles. It's very difficult for her to get over there and see him. And of course, he didn't even know that this had happened to her. He was trying to call her for days and didn't find out, I think, until Saturday or Sunday. And it was very frustrating and anxious time. But she does seem to be on the mend. Hopefully she'll be getting out of the hospital. If not today, then tomorrow. We'll be keeping people updated on that on the website as well. Thanks for being a part of the show tonight, Carrie, and thanks for your continued efforts on the website. Bill, I want to thank you very much for stopping by as well.
Okay, it's been fun.
Wish you luck in your continued journey across the land.
Yes, that was a rather interesting comment from that caller. I mean, everybody, please wish me luck, and everything seems to be okay now. I mean, we had a little scary incident that happened just when we arrived here, but I'd rather not talk about it.
Okay. Well, we'll just leave it at that for now. Maybe we'll get into it in future shows. That's it for this week. That's Emmanuel Goldstein for Off the Hook. We'll be back again next week. Coming up immediately following this this program is the continuing coverage by Pacifica News. Arab Voices will be heard at 10 minutes after 9 o'clock, so you can hear it at that point in time. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll be continuing Pacifica News coverage of today's Election Day coverage. Find out who won, who lost, and just how much things will be changing in the years ahead. Until next week, good night.
Now I can't make a call. I couldn't get much worse. But if they could, they would. Well, they'd be bound for the best, expect the worst.
From Pacifica Network News, this is Election Night Special Report. I'm Larry Bensky with an update of races around the country and a shocker coming in at this hour. The networks are declaring just as the polls close in New York that longtime Senator Alphonse D'Amato has been defeated by Charles Schumer, his Democratic challenger. If true, this would perhaps lead to a Democrat pickup of seats in the United States Senate on a night when Republicans were talking about possibly increasing their margin to a veto-proof level. Let's go right to the Senate races here in this update and take a look at what's happened so far. As we reported earlier, the Democrats, as expected, have picked up a Republican Senate seat in Indiana. The seat once held by Dan Coats is now held by Evan Bayh, the former Indiana governor who won easily there. Big surprise in North Carolina, where 45-year-old John Edwards, a Democrat, has upset one-term Senator Locke Faircloth for a pickup for the Democrats there. In Arkansas, Blanche Lambert Lincoln,